Welcome, listeners. I'm your host, Nikki Tran. I was very excited to be able to talk to Bonnie Maldonado, especially this week. We recorded this episode this past Thursday, June 4th. Dr. Maldonado is not only a professor of pediatrics, infectious disease, epidemiology, and population health at the Stanford School of Medicine, but she's also the senior associate dean of Stanford's Department of Faculty Development and Diversity. She's been a fixture recently on many Stanford town halls, focusing on things from COVID-19 to health inequalities to racial injustice and discrimination. As everyone's aware, following George Floyd's murder, there have been a nationwide mass protest. Given what you've heard from the community and at Stanford's town hall, is there any key messages that you'd like to share with us?
I do think that this is an important time for us to express our solidarity and our compassion and our empathy and our willingness to listen and to be embrace our community who might be in pain and feeling fear and anxiety about what's going on, and to be really try to engage in whatever way we can to help not only our immediate community but these issues in general that have been a problem for forever, for many, many years. And it's time for us to, you know, again, to have a call to action and really make good on those promises.
And part of that call to action is a lot of people have been protesting. And I was just curious if you've seen the open letter by UCSF's Peter Chin Hong. It basically requests that police do not use tear gas and do not arrest protesters because of the risk of spreading COVID. If you have any comments about safe protesting and what things you think that would be important for that.
Right. So I didn't actually read the letter, but I did know, I know what was said, and I understand the concerns. I think the issues of being arrested, using tear gas, bringing people in close quarters. I do have concerns because these are populations that are obviously worried about bigger issues, bigger picture issues in a societal level. And it's hard to think about individual concerns like COVID, but I would look at them as safety issues as well for individuals. So I think to the extent possible, when people do protest, if they can do it safely, that is by wearing masks and keeping a distance and keeping those masks on properly, making sure that the, you know, again, I do agree that the, you know, I just have not in my lifetime here in the Bay Area, I've not seen this much tear gas being used. I don't understand why that's even happening. I would imagine there are other ways to disperse people. And I feel like there's been indiscriminate use of tear gas. But again, I'm not a police officer, but I just feel like there would be other ways to de-escalate issues and to harm people. And so I do think that this is not a good time to use tear gas when you've got, you know, when it clearly will cause people to tear and cause people to cough. And those are exactly the things that you want to avoid during a time like this. For all we know, again, we know that these things are irritants to the respiratory tract, and whether that's a factor in infection of this virus or not, it's still harmful to the respiratory tract and the eyes. And so I do agree. I think that's not helpful. And to the extent that I think we need to be, you know, when we're struggling right now, and I know that at the state level, the governor is talking about closing two prisons. Now that's a whole different correctional institution. But why are we talking about arresting and putting people into jail for civil disobedience? I think that's, you know, I think there has to be a way to learn how to be more judicious in the way that we deal with that.
One thing that really struck me was that as of mid-May, 1 in 2,000 African Americans had died of coronavirus. And that over the course of a lifetime, there's a 1 in 1,000 chance of a Black man being killed by police in the United States. Both of these are 2.5 times higher than for their white counterparts. Given your work looking at the epidemiological aspects of COVID-19, what do you think are the overlaps that cause both of these numbers to be so disproportionately high?
Well, I do think that there are a number of overlaps that we talked about. I did have a separate town hall a week ago now, on COVID and racial and ethnic disparities. And we do know that there are quite a number of issues that overlap there. And we're talking about issues such as determinants of health, for example. When we talk about health disparities and health equity in general, we know that the infection rates are much higher among Latinx and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander populations. They are higher as well in Black African American populations, but the death rates are extremely high among the Black population, even relative to other racial and ethnic minorities. And again, the intersection here has to do with the social determinants of health. And those include things that will lead to further bad outcomes in populations who don't have access, such as access to care or insurance coverage, the ability to seek care or the timing of care when people have impacted work hours or other responsibilities or lack of transportation or even funds to seek care. There are a number of higher rates of underlying comorbidities in minority populations. Structural conditions, including inability to self-isolate in crowded living spaces, necessary reliance on public transport, other people may have ability to avoid, higher prevalence of certain demographic groups and certain essential jobs, and also underlying a lot of this is limited job and economic security. So those are just a few of the many areas where we think there are overlaps.
A lot of these are very hypothesis generating. These are ideas that people are having and that they want to explore. Can you talk about the kind of work people are actively doing right now?
Yeah, so right now, this is, as you know, this is a very new field, right? We are just starting to understand this virus. I think what we have been doing so far is just trying to collate data, understand where the data are, and of the many data sets that are just starting to be developed, try to build out a better understanding of what the problem is. As an epidemiologist, what I like to do first is look at what the data is like today so that I can understand what the needs are, what's the next steps that I need to take. But it's very clear just from looking at where we are that there are some major disparities in race and ethnicity and infection rates and mortality rates. And so why is that? All the things I just mentioned are areas that would be really important to understand. We are starting to look at those in many different populations, but those are just getting off the ground. And by that, I mean, we here in my office are starting a very large seroprevalence and incidence study of COVID-19 in the Bay Area, where we're looking at populations from around the Bay Area to look at new infection rates over the next several months and trying to see where those infections might occur and in what populations and what the reasons are for that. And so that's why we, you know, because of the lack of data and the lack of research, we're actually trying to that's why we're offering these grants. We're offering actually up to $60,000 in grant funds for small pilot projects to do studies around COVID and racial and ethnic disparities.
That's really awesome to hear that at least there's opportunities for people to try to do this kind of work. For your own work, your seroprevalence study, can you describe for us a little bit what it is, but also more importantly, what factors you're trying to take into account when you were designing the study so that you don't end up with these kinds of gaps in data?
Well, so that's exactly the issue, right? And what we're trying to do is really get a very clear demographic picture representative of the whole Bay Area population of new infection rates in individuals from those areas by collecting a random sample of people. It's in collaboration with UC San Francisco and the Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital. What we're trying to do is we want to understand in general what's going on in the San Francisco Bay Area. We would like to know what's going on in the whole country, but we wanted to start at least within our own general region. the main ones. We obviously will be working indirectly with the other three counties around us, but San Mateo, Santa Clara, Contra Costa, Alameda, Marin, and San Francisco. And the idea there would be to get a snapshot, as I said, of the whole population, but especially to try to really look for those populations that we think might be missed otherwise. So to that extent, we have been partnering with the county health departments. We are partnering with community health organizations, with federally qualified health centers, where a lot of underserved populations may work and get their care. By collecting a random sample of people who would be able to enroll in this study and then be followed every month until the end of December to look for new PCR diagnosed infections, as well as antibody testing to look for evidence of previous recent exposure. This is a study that is funded by Priscilla Chan and Mark Zuckerberg. And we're actually seeking additional funds because this study is a big study. It's reasonably expensive, but it's not enough to really get at everything you want to answer. Obviously, you can never answer all your questions. We're going to try to seek additional funds to even work, look even further at really other disenfranchised populations, such as homeless populations and migrant populations. And that would take additional funds with more resources to really try to find those people. Because we also don't want to forget the overall demographics of the Bay Area. And to try to do it all in one study is very difficult. So we're running that study and we're seeking funds to do additional work around homeless and migrant populations, especially those that work in agriculture and other farm migrant related industries. And then the other population we'll be looking at are healthcare workers, because that is a group that presumably could be at high risk. And so we'll be looking at healthcare workers as well at UC San Francisco, Zuckerberg, San Francisco General Hospital, and Stanford. It is meant to be a real-time study. So as we're testing people, we will be giving that information right back to the counties. We are obligated to tell the counties if we find a positive individual, not antibody positive, but PCR positive. So if somebody's actively infected, we're mandated to report that to the county. So for example, let's just say next week we find three infected individuals coming from, say, the same region, neighborhood, whatever it might be. That's data that the county where those people live can use to say what's going on in that neighborhood. Is there something that we need to address? Is there a mitigation that we need to put into place, given that we're starting to remove some of rules around distancing, et cetera? So I think they'll be able to get a lot of useful information out of this to make policies around, you know, if things are quiet and we're not seeing a rise in infection, then perhaps they can keep moving slowly. Again, this is just one piece of the information that they're going to be getting. They're going to be getting multiple sources of information, but we think this will be one area where we can affect policy directly.
And how are you recruiting for these programs and how can you ensure that you have a representative sample?
We have set up a sampling scheme that would select people who represent the demographics, as I said, of the Bay Area. And the focus would be age, gender, zip code of residence, but also not only just zip code, but also zip code relative to socioeconomic status. Because as you know, some zip codes may be quite diverse in terms of socioeconomic status. So those are the major areas. And then to the extent that we can also, we will be trying to analyze for racial and ethnic trends as well.
Even given how comprehensive this is, what gaps still do you think will exist in this kind of data? And then what other teams would you like to find to work on other congruous issues?
Well, I think, so first of all, this is really just an incidence and study that is looking at new infection rates. And I can tell you about the other studies that are going on in the area that we're not doing and one that we are doing. I'll tell you about those in a second. But remember, we're looking just at the kind of the quantitative aspects here. There's a lot of work that needs to be done around the qualitative aspects that have to do with all of the things I mentioned around health disparities. How do we deal with all those problems? What are the social, economic, psychological factors that go into all of the areas of health determinants, social determinants of health, that we are not addressing with this study. So that whole area is just not part of this, because it can't be. It's just, it's a just a very big area that we're hoping some of our behavioral colleagues, researchers, will be able to take into account with studies like these. So coming back to the other studies that are similar, we're actually, I'm working separately with the Chan Zuckerberg BioHub, which is a research-based program that's a collaboration between UC San Francisco, UC Berkeley, and Stanford to try to build out home test kits to, again, do the very similar thing, get people to sign in, ask for kits, have them sent out to households, and then have people swab themselves and send us their kits back so that we can actually do a regular screening of people in the community. Because it'll be self-enrolled, that's clearly going to be a biased sample. Those are going to be people who are aware of being able to get online and to sign themselves up, et cetera, and who have addresses.
So if I was to just Google Chan Zuckerberg BioHub self-test COVID-19, would I be able to enroll myself now?
We're working on setting it up. We don't have that study yet. We're have to work out the logistics of getting the test kit approved by the FDA and get all of that in order. So we're hoping to start by July. In order to get a more representative sample, what we'd like to do is say, make sure that the advertisement for that goes out to populations maybe that aren't English speaking that would like to know about this, and get this into social media networks that reach a very diverse group of people other than those that are probably have the time and the ability to be more tech savvy. The other study that is going on that's going to be starting soon as well is a study of 5,000 households in Alameda and Contra Costa County. That's being run by two of my colleagues at UC Berkeley, Lisa Barcelos and Eva Harris, and they are PhD epidemiologists who've been working in infectious disease epidemiology around the U.S. and the world for many, many years. And they've been able to really build up a group of 5,000 volunteers who have also been willing to be involved in a similar study to ours. It's a household study, and it's a little different because they've picked households and they will be sending them test kits and also be following them for on a regular basis every 6 to 8 weeks, I believe it is. That study has not started yet. It'll be important for us to put our data together so that we can really get fill in any of the gaps that might exist between our two studies.
And then given previous knowledge, what do you expect from household transmission studies?
Yeah, so I actually was funded very early in March to do a household transmission study that I'm doing right now, primarily because of the data that came out of China. The data from Italy wasn't available yet when I got the funding. And my study actually didn't start until the beginning of April because it took us a month to find swabs. We couldn't even get swabs to really do our study. The study that I'm doing is looking at everybody in a household, and we're having them swab themselves every day for 21 days to try to understand how long do people shed virus, what's the titer of the virus, how many people in the household become infected, and what might be the nature of the dynamics of transmission. But it's very clear from studies in China and now in Italy that, and this is pretty expected, I would imagine, households are a very common source of transmission for many diseases because of an epidemiologic term called the force of infection. So the force of infection basically just means, you know, there's just a lot more opportunity for exposure over a more prolonged period of time. And so that will result in potentially more opportunities for spread of disease within households. So these studies will be somewhat useful there, but I think the household transmission study that I'm doing hopefully will give us a little more granularity about the kinetics of what happens with household transmission.
Given that you're testing people every day for 21 days, do you anticipate being able to pick up, say, when a husband gives the disease to his wife and be able to actually test her before she's infectious and then while she becomes infectious and while she's symptomatic?
So that's generally the idea, yes. We'll be able to see partners, household, other household members, children, if there are children, to identify whether or not there is transmission. And again, if we can see whether the a degree of viral load and symptomatology of the infected individual, the index case, if that, how that impacts transmission, because there is also very good data now suggesting that the degree of transmission really depends to a large extent on the degree of symptoms in a person and also the viral load. And then other studies now are on the contrary are showing that there may be super spreaders that may not be that sick, but may actually still spread in quite large numbers. And so we have to really try to come to some understanding of what are the various factors that go into having this virus disseminate within populations.
Although I suppose both can be true, that for the most part, the more symptomatic you are, the higher your viral load, the more contagious, but that there could be individuals that don't show symptoms but are still super spreaders.
Yeah, and I don't understand. I've never really understand that term, super spreaders. I don't really know what that means. It would be nice if I had a scientific definition for what that means. So does it mean they're more infectious? Does it mean that they're immune? They've got immune correlates that prevent them from mounting a sufficient response so that the virus is present longer in their body. What exactly does a super spreader mean? We can only describe it in epidemiologic terms or just in clinical terms. You know, somebody, there was an outbreak and many, many people got infected from one person. So as you heard, there was a recent study where 80% of infections came from only 20% of the outbreaks. And why that is not clear. I don't know if there's such a thing as a super spreader phenotype or genotype. Are there certain people who are more likely to spread, or is there just something unique about those environments, or maybe, what is it that characterizes a super spreading event that doesn't happen in non-super spreading events?
So you're saying that it's still unclear if super spreaders are caused by some differences in the biology of the disease, or if they're caused by some social situation, like a person with average infectious potential being put into a situation where they have the opportunity to affect a lot of people, like singing in a church choir or eating at a restaurant in front of a fan. That maybe it's the social part, not the biology part, that might really matter, but that we just don't have the data yet to really know.
Absolutely. So that would be really important to understand. We did see that happen, for example, with SARS. The problem there, and it was a good problem to have, is that the virus disappeared before we could really understand it. So we do know it's happened before, but we just don't understand what that means.
It seems like there's still a lot of data to gather. Thank you very much for sharing your current projects with us. I really appreciate not only your time, but there are people like you working to make sure we can gather socially equitable health data.
Sure, absolutely. You asked great questions, and it made me really think a lot about what we're doing, and hopefully we'll have more results for you down the line.